Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. And the first word you hear this morning, not since Bangladesh. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. It's very nice to have you on this Wednesday morning. We have a terrific crew here assembled, all here and in their places. We'll get to the introductions in just a moment. In the meantime, let me remind you that you can always be a part of this program. It may not seem like it, but all you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We do not promise to get to every letter. We will not get to every letter. We get a lot of them. So what we try to do is get a cross-section, a sample of what people are saying. One per customer, keep them short and sweet, and that's it for the rules for the moment. There are many more, but I don't want to seem like I'm being, you know, overly harsh. Panel@wamc.org is how you reach us, and we do love your letters. Okay. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you, sir?
Dry basement. I'm happy.
Okay, good. Good, good, good. Did you find somebody?
Did I find
somebody to...
No.
Or, no, it was all you.
It all came in. I worked like a slave getting it out, but it was to no avail. I came home yesterday. The basement was dry. So unless there's something strange going on...
No, it's just the things that get wet can dry up.
I understand how the water gets in. I don't get is how the water gets out.
Yeah, I think it's seepage, right?
Well, we know the water gets in through the stones.
Yes.
But we don't know how it goes from, you know, an inch or two on the floor to out of the building.
Welcome back to Vox Pop this morning.
Don't you see?
It is fascinating. I know I have not asked you this question over the many days that we've discussed this, but what is the state of your basement? Like, are you a typical old house basement?
No, it's an old house.
Or is it a finished basement?
No, it's not a finished basement.
Okay, all right. No. So that's
Roselle would like a finished basement, and we really can't figure that out. But in the meantime, it's one of those old basements.
Yeah, and those are hard.
1912.
Those are really, really hard to get to the point where they don't have any water. And when you finish them, you still get the water, which is even
worse.
Actually,
we have not had real water in this basement until this
go-around. Yes. Well, I'm glad you are here. I'm glad that you are dry, and I thank you very much. Chris Churchill is sitting right next to you. He is the Times Union columnist, our good friend, and we thank you for being here. Sir, how are you?
I'm good. Basement is dry, as far as I know.
Did you ever
I haven't
go
checked
down
on
there?
It in a little while, but I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
As of 7:30, anyway. It seemed pretty good. Yeah. Siena College professor of comparative politics, Vera Acarius Kelly, joins us and filling in this morning, and I thank you very much for doing that. You're on today and tomorrow? Is that right?
No, not tomorrow.
Just today.
I switched.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So, you know, you don't have to suffer through me twice.
No, but I'm just glad you're here and we didn't miss out on you. That's great.
Well, no, I'm glad I'm here.
Very good to be here. Vera, normally a Thursday guest, but a Wednesday guest today, and we couldn't be more thrilled. And also, speaking of thrilled, we get to meet a panelist who's been on our program for quite a while, but all during COVID, so we never got a chance to meet her, and she is now in the studio, and we are just thrilled. Chief of Staff and President, Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont. Malia, good morning. Welcome to Albany. Welcome to WAMC. It's great to have you here.
Good morning. I'm so glad to be here in person and see all of your smiling faces.
Yeah. Incredible. That's
It'll
what
be
you
smiling
look like.
For long.
Yes, she seated close to the door, ready to make her escape to Kingston. We're very happy and obviously very lucky to have you here, and we thank you very much for spending time with us. Again, for listeners, panel@wamc.org, if you would like to be with us and to check in. So we've been talking about this subject all week. And for good reason, of course, it is important. And yesterday, the president spoke about voting in this country. He called passing voting legislation a national imperative and castigated voting restrictions based on, quote, a big lie. The president was in Philadelphia yesterday. He delivered his most forceful condemnation yet on the wave of voting restrictions is how I'll say it, proposed in Republican-led states nationwide, efforts the president argued are the biggest threat to American democracy since the Civil War. Biden's speech was an attempt to inject new life into flagging efforts to pass federal legislation addressing the issue. But while he intensified his explanation of the stakes, his speech did not include a call for the Senate to change the filibuster, which is seen by advocates as the best and perhaps only way to usher in the kinds of changes that Biden is seeking. Biden spoke at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia in a room filled with images of Benjamin Franklin and quotes from Daniel Webster and Theodore Roosevelt. He compared the new laws to voter suppression by the Ku Klux Klan to the Jim Crow era laws that disenfranchised nearly all voters who were not white and male. He railed against laws that restrict access, calling them raw and sustained election subversion, and said that the 2022 midterm elections could highlight the damaging effects of the new laws. This is a test of our time, he told civil rights advocates who were in attendance. Hear me clearly. There's an unfolding assault taking place in America today, an attempt to suppress and subvert the right to vote and fair and free elections, an assault on democracy, an assault on liberty, an assault on who we are. Alan.
You know, this is a scary, scary thing. And the speech was excellent. The passion, whatever he could do, was there. But I have to say, you cannot minimize what the risk is to this country, to our democratic values, and to the way that we are, the way we have to face up to this scandalous ex-president and what he is trying to do here. There's an attempt, state by state, to rob this election. And we know it and we see it. And I'm glad that he said what he said, and I'm glad he said it in the place he said it, because everything is at stake here.
Chris Churchill.
I think it was a very good speech, so I guess I disagree with Alan on that.
Well, cut it out, will you please?
Are we allowed to do that? Or do we
have, absolutely. You know,
What didn't you like?
I thought, for one thing, it was hyperbolic. I think the stuff about the Klan and a new Jim Crow and the word, you know, biggest threat to democracy since the Civil War is kind of a little bit ignorant of American history. We've had a lot of threats to democracy. And I think, you know, the rise of Jim Crow itself was a bigger threat to democracy than what's than
robbing the American government, Chris, and from us and downplaying voting and the way that that we are voting in this country and changing the voting laws.
Well, I think
he was on the money.
I think a lot of voters will look at what he said yesterday and then look at what the Texas law actually does and think that he was exaggerating. I mean, the Texas law bans drive-through voting, which we don't have in New York. It bans 24-hour voting, which we don't have in New York. It bans the distribution of unsolicited mail-in ballots, another thing we don't have in New York. I mean, if you go down the list, it doesn't do a lot of what a lot of the critics of it says. I'm not saying it's a good law, don't get me wrong, but I just think the rhetoric was almost Trumpian. I mean, it's like it's exaggerating your point to the point of ridiculousness. And my second criticism of the speech is that it doesn't lead anywhere. HR 1 is not going to pass. They don't have the votes for it. He didn't call for an end to the filibuster. So it was a lot of air in service of what exactly? I don't know what the end result is. And the third thing is, I think the Democrats in a lot of ways are focusing on the wrong thing. They're focusing almost entirely on voting when I think the real threat is on the counting. If you want to talk about the subversion of democracy, then look at like the Electoral Count Act, which is the act that pretty much allowed the riot to take place, right? I mean, it's not about voting; it's about what happens after the votes are counted, in my opinion.
What about poll watchers? And also, it's not just Texas, mm-hmm. obviously.
Well, I know, and it gets complicated because you know every state has different laws. And
way to go, Joe.
My seat is sinking. So, is that what you do to people who disagree?
No, it's just a matter of how much.
Next thing I know, I'll be ejected through the floor, and I'll be out on the sidewalk.
You'll be in the basement before.
In his wet basement.
My hands are on the table.
Okay, so all right. Well, let's go around and then we'll flesh this out a little bit, Malia.
So I'm glad that Biden is trying to stake this out as one of his key issues that he wants to bring attention to. I don't necessarily fault him at this point for not laying out exactly how the filibuster will be handled or anything like that. I think he's trying to make a larger statement. We can quibble about whether he was hyperbolic or not. But just staking this out as a key issue for his presidency, I think, is important. I would agree with Chris in terms of moving forward. This is not just about voting. The issue I'm concerned about is gerrymandering. And that's something that I hope local officials will be paying more attention to. And so there are a lot of different ways that local state officials could take up this call that Biden is putting forward. And I hope they'll do that in a lot of different ways, especially around gerrymandering.
Vera.
So I think I want to reflect on the larger issue of the Georgia voting law. I think that has really scared the Democrats and a lot of other people who are watching the process of what is underway in certain states. To Chris's comment on New York State, I think New York State does not have a forward-thinking electoral law at all. And I would think in a functioning liberal democracy, you should reflect on how to encourage voting participation. So mailing out ballots to all voters is just fine. Allowing people to vote on Sundays, such as in New York, that is not really happening, right? A lot of times we don't pick holidays. I think all of these questions are about who is encouraged to participate in elections and who is focused, who do we focus on in terms of excluding? That is often inner city communities, and a lot of things are done to exclude people that have mobility issues. It could be remote rural communities. It certainly is inner city communities, sort of the kind of restrictions that are put in place to just make it miserable or complicated or exhausting or impossible for less privileged people to participate in an election is very disturbing. Such as coming back to the Georgia issue, not having food and water in a long line. Why is there a long line? Why aren't there opportunities to drop your vote everywhere in boxes? Why are boxes removed? Those are the kinds of questions that I think the Texas legislature needs to consider. And there's a clear emphasis on excluding Latino voters in this case in Texas.
How?
Because people work very long hours. Right.
And I should say, I'm all for expanding voting as much as possible, but Texas will still have more liberal voting laws. And I'm talking about the voting, not what happens after the voting.
I don't know that this matters, but your home state.
Texas? No, I'm not from Texas.
Oh, no.
I went to college there.
So there was a rumor.
Okay. Yeah, debunk that real quick. All right, go ahead.
It probably has more liberal voting laws in my home state, too, which I guess is Massachusetts. But
I guess.
Oh, yeah. Cut it out.
We moved around a bit. But, I mean, it'll have more early voting days than New York. Like, the list of things that I read off, New York doesn't have any of those things.
It's a problem.
So to call what they're doing, if they move back to a position where they're still more liberal than New York, to call that a new Jim Crow, I think, is bizarre. And I think it won't resonate. I think the problem with the rhetoric is that people will look at it and conclude that it's dishonest, and then they'll just blow the whole issue off, which they shouldn't do because, like I said, it's what happens after the voting.
But to quote a great sage in my life, two wrongs don't make a right. Yeah. And so what is happening in New York still isn't right. We should have 24-hour voting.
Okay, then Biden should call out New York and Pennsylvania and Massachusetts.
But you know what they're trying to do. They're trying to repress the vote, and you know it, Chris. So I don't see how you can go where you're going.
I don't think a ban on drive-through voting, what's the word you used?
Represses.
Is it repressive necessarily?
Well, why else would you do it? What's wrong with drive-through voting?
Empowering
especially in Texas, where you can do drive-in everything.
You can buy drive-through beer in Texas.
The brew-through.
It's a large state.
Or
maybe some people wouldn't drive-through.
Yeah.
Hey. Or empowering the galoots who are there to basically, be oppressive to the people who want to vote. How many people can arrive in a car? Come on, Chris, you know better than this. You're an outstanding, brilliant man.
Watch out! Whenever he says that, the assault is coming.
Yeah, the chair starts sinking through the floor again. Yeah.
I don't think the rhetoric of Biden. So people, Chris, as you said, people who might be off put by the rhetoric, even if the rhetoric weren't as strong, they would still be off put by it. Right. They're people who would disagree with Biden anyway. So I'm not sure, you know, we may agree that it's a little bit hyperbolic, but I don't think it's going to change a lot of people's minds about the issues.
The speech, I think, was designed to rally a base that is upset that he hasn't talked about
this
more.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. We were talking about this earlier on the show that they have not done enough. Democrats have not done enough to seize on this.
Or to stop the guy from stealing the democracy.
But if you want to stop somebody from stealing the democracy, you focus on what happens after the vote. And they're almost completely ignoring that. Address the Electoral Count Act. Address the act what they were doing in the Capitol on the day of the January 6th riot is directly the result of the Electoral Count Act. You don't have to have any of that. You can change the way you certify and count votes in this country, and you could probably get Republican senators on board with that. What they're doing just doesn't, in my opinion, really address what the real threat is, and that's what happens after the vote.
I realize that this is probably an overstatement, but the gist to me is that they're looking at all of the things that went wrong in being able to overturn the vote, and saying, well, these were the logical things that happened, that were all of the tools that were used that did not allow the big lie to become a fact, and they're changing it.
Yeah.
The state legislatures are doing that?
Yes.
I think the Electoral Count Act is one of the things that allowed, which is an act passed by Congress in 1877 after a hugely contested election. The act is a mess. Almost everybody agrees. Well, everybody agrees the thing is a mess and that it's confusing and that it needs to change. And there's been no talk on the lawmaker level of changing that.
Before we even got to January, though, what would have happened in Georgia if the elections commissioner was not not as strong as he was to Trump and to the power, and also to what would happen in Arizona and in Pennsylvania? And if you then weaken their power, doesn't the problem then become those individuals issue?
Right. But the HR1 does almost nothing to change that. I mean, there is very little. It's focused entirely on what happens before and on Election Day, and almost nothing on what happens afterwards. And I think that's the flaw in it. If you want to say that, you know, I think some of that could be addressed with the Electoral Count Act. You could say that the legislatures. I mean, some of this is in the Constitution. You might have to do it by constitutional amendment. It gets complicated, but you might be able to say a state must abide by the popular vote in its state and that the legislature can't overturn that. There are different things that they could do. But, you know, to focus on things like drive-through voting that most states don't have, including most northern states, where nobody's using words like Jim Crow or Ku Klux Klan, I think is wrong-headed.
We want to have more of a discussion on this, and we're getting letters, Chris. So get ready for that. We'll take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation here on WAMC.
And I'm hoping that the car won't break down as I'm headed southbound.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Malia Dumont, and Vera Acarius Kelly here with us. We have a wonderful panel, and we welcome you, our listeners, to chime in. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. As I mentioned, we've got letters on what we were discussing about voting restrictions and the president's speech in Philadelphia yesterday. Diane says, I thought the president's speech was excellent. However, I feel he did not go far enough. Most Americans already know the extent of danger we are in. President Biden is doing a great job, but I feel he did not hit the mark with his speech. He made no reference to the filibuster and offered no plans to address the main obstacle, which is the filibuster. We need action, not rhetoric. So that is a good point. We haven't really discussed that part of it yet, which is the filibuster and the president seeming to stay away from that issue.
Well, I think that he knows, as I know, and we all should, that if the Democrats lose the majority in those two houses in this coming election, the other guys are going to have, you know, freedom to do whatever the hell they want with the filibuster, because of the filibuster on their side in that case. I think it's a very dangerous question. Most of the people listening to this radio station want the filibuster gone, and then they want the Democrats to do whatever they will. But you got to look around the corner in this game, that's for sure. Now, as far as the speech, I thought the speech was sensational. I thought he did what he had to do. He was being pressured by people like the letter writer and others who just demanded that, with the potential for the society becoming as undemocratized as we're seeing, that something had to be done, and he was out there doing it.
So, Malia, if one of the ways that this seems the current legislation that is making its way through Washington, if the way to pass that is, or the only way to pass it, which many say is dealing with the filibuster, should that have been a part of the speech?
Not necessarily. So the White House did two things yesterday. One is Biden gave his speech. And two is Vice President Harris had a strategy meeting with other people in the White House. So I would love to know what the outcome of that strategy meeting is. I think that has to be a next step pretty clearly to show, you know, what direction they're heading, what they intend to do. So Biden lays out this call, sort of a call to action, and then, you know, what is the action? He didn't need to say it at the same time, but I think it needs to come pretty quickly afterwards. And also the Democratic National Committee, where are they on this? You know, Chris points out that there's sort of a lack of a feeling of strategy. You know, whether or not it was included in the speech, as long as it's following on quickly, I think it shows that the White House is serious about this.
Yeah, I mean, that was my second criticism of the speech. It just doesn't lead to anything.
We only got to one?
Well, yeah. No, I said I had two at the beginning. Yeah.
All right.
It just didn't lead to anything. What does it change on the ground? You can, and even if he had talked about the filibuster, I'm not sure they have the votes to get rid of the filibuster anyways. Manchin's not going to go along with that. So, you know, if he wanted, maybe he should have endorsed the Manchin voting rights bill, because that one can actually pass.
But I think the speech was also in response to Claiborne's critique, his Biden's unwillingness to actually be more forceful when it comes to issues related to voting rights. I think it was the first time we heard President Biden speak forcefully on the issue of voting rights. And I think it was the first step in that direction. And now we will likely see some conversation about strategy, and obviously, you know, the Texas representatives having had the meeting with Harris yesterday. All of these things fall into place. It was the first time we heard the president. Now, this is a public relations effort.
Absolutely.
And that's what it's about.
It was a reactionary, no, don't take it the wrong way, reactionary speech to the pressures that Democrats all over the country and independents are putting on him to get out there and say something.
All right. I have one letter with a subject line that says, "Thank you, Chris." I have another letter that says, "Chris is nuts." Which would you like me to read first?
I'll go with the Chris is nuts.
Door number two.
Get it out of the way.
Paul says, "Chris's point that counting is what counts the most is naive. If you can't get to the poll in the first place, there is nothing to count."
Well, I would agree with that, but I mean, again, we're talking about a bunch of different states. If we're talking about the Texas law, the Georgia law, they are still more, to use a strange word in the context, they're still more liberal than New York and most northern states on their voting, on their early voting, on their hours. So if you're going to say, and maybe this is an argument for nationalizing it, which is somewhat what HR1 does, but if you're going to say that it's a threat to democracy, then you have to at least acknowledge that New York is a threat to democracy, and that every other presidential election we've ever held was held under stricter rules.
We got this letter from John, who said, "I appreciate Chris's comment on Biden's hyperbole. The panel needs to get real about the many ways that Democratic-controlled states limit access to voting and real small-d democracy."
I mean, I think it's an insult to Jim Crow, to what Jim Crow really was, to call this a new Jim Crow. Jim Crow really did keep people from voting. It didn't matter what you did or how much effort you put in, you could not. And yes, voting is still too restrictive in this country. I think there's a lot of things we should do including here, and there seems to be no pressure whatsoever to open voting up in a lot of northern states. It seems to be only focused on the states that were close in the presidential election.
But just for the hell of it, why do you think all of this is happening in all of these states right now? You think it's just they're tightening up their laws and making it clear that secretaries of state can't step in, even their own secretaries of state can't step in and call foul?
I do think that in part these laws, and I agree with where you're going, that these are a reaction to the Republican base's anger over what they consider to be a stolen election. Absolutely.
Even though they say their own states had no part in that stolen election, right. and they stand up for their vote and their vote count, and yet they changed the rules that apparently worked.
Well, in their states, what they're calling the stolen election is, oh my gosh, minority voters participated at a higher percentage.
Absolutely.
And that's what they want to roll back, because they believe that new access provided more minority voters the right to participate, and that is what
they're interested in rolling back. I do think that there are people who are legitimately concerned about people voting, about voter fraud and various things. And we can argue with them and say that, it didn't happen or it doesn't happen very often. But I wouldn't just automatically dismiss some of their concerns when you're talking about, ballots being mailed to every home and things like that. I think that some people have legitimate concerns about that stuff.
God help us if people are going to go out and vote, either by mail or by car, or too many people in one car. Come on, Chris, you know better.
Have you ever voted by car, Alan?
Yes, I vote by car. All the time.
But I, as a European citizen, can get my ballot, mailed to me here in the U.S. They do international mailing, so I can participate in my home country election.
Do you have to ask for it?
Yeah. I asked for it because I'm abroad.
Right. Well, the Americans can do the same things. We can all do the same. We can all do that. I mean,
educated and privileged. This is something to actually expand opportunities to people who usually don't have time to vote, don't understand the voting rights and rules. I mean, this is the complication, because there's so many. You have to have the right ID. You have to have the right. You can't have a PO in certain states. You have to have a home. I mean, these are issues that are raised with a particular interest in excluding potential voters.
What about the car thing, Chris? What about having too many people in a car? What about that?
Are you talking about
the carpooling? If you put five or six people in a van and bring them to the polls, that you have to file paperwork to do that.
And I guarantee you, if there are five black people, it's going to be taken a whole lot differently than if there are five white people in that car.
Yeah, they're going to be stopped because they might be having a taillight out before they get to the voting.
I think that this, to get back to the letter writer's point, though, I've lived all over the country, and I used to be a poll worker in Virginia when I lived there. And the worst voting experience I've ever had was when I voted in the 2016 presidential election in New York City. And it was so disorganized, and it really was an injustice for everyone who was trying to vote there. Now, it's not mutually exclusive from the other issues we're talking about, but there is a lot of attention that needs to be paid to how our voting systems are working here.
Just look at the mayoral race and the disaster that happened after the counting disaster.
It's an embarrassment.
I'm going to keep beating this drum, but I think a lot more attention has to be focused on what happens after the voting. I mean, that's where an election could be subverted. If you're really concerned about what happened on January 6th and what Trump did, then take a close look at the Electoral Count Act. Look at the things that almost got us to that point on January 6th. What if Mike Pence had not taken the stand that he had taken? What if there had been a different composition in the House and in the Senate? You might have a different, totally different situation, and it's the Electoral Count Act that made that all that possible.
I agree with you, but I also agree with the letter writer that said if you can't get to the polls and you can't vote, then it doesn't really matter. I mean, you have less votes to count then.
Right, and I agree with that. I mean, all for opening up voting access. I'm just saying that if you're complaining about laws that when they're implemented are still more liberal than what New York has, I think you're being at least a little bit hypocritical. I mean, Biden should look at his own state of Delaware. Their voting laws are far stricter than what Georgia and Texas put in
place. Look, I'm so pleased you're here. I mean that.
Now, here comes the show. Hold on to your
check
chair.
Your seat.
So clear that this is a massive effort to steal an election and changing all of these laws in all of these states at the same time. You think this is coming out of the ether? No. This is an effort to say, okay, this is why we lost, and here's how we have to do it in order to fully steal it. Come on, Chris.
I mean, I do. But I do agree.
You're not going to defend Chris,
no,
are you?
No, I'm not going to defend Chris, but I am going to say, and we have a ton of letters, and we'll get to those right after the break. But I will say, you know, it does seem hypocritical to me as well to have Chuck Schumer talking about the importance of this legislation and moving it through, and yet not addressing the inequities in his very own state that he represents. And I think, I mean, that's sort of key to what you're talking about,
right?
Yeah, and I wish that was part of it, too.
The larger issue is they're trying to steal the damn election.
And right. So we don't have to worry about it.
Sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, go ahead. That's fine. No, you're on fire. You go.
If Biden's speech yesterday had talked about restrictions in New York and other blue states, and he hadn't put red states and Republicans on so much on the defensive, don't you think they might get more buy-in for something like H.R. 1 or for some sort of reform? When you only blame a handful of states and you say they're the problem and you ignore the problems in your own backyard, I think you're alienating not only voters but also potential votes.
You are terrific, but here's the problem. The problem is they're trying to steal the election.
What would steal the election? The Electoral
Count Act.
I'm
telling you what. They are changing the rules and the laws in all of these states right now. So you can come back and say, okay, somebody picked their nose in New York State. But really, you'd have to be I don't want to use bad words here that will get people mad at me, but you just have to be not understanding of what's going on. And we know what's going on. It's as plain as the nose.
I don't know what
bad words are. In certain states, they're targeting subgroups of populations to exclude them from voting. And that is a very dangerous development because that is a way to make sure certain groups of people don't participate in the election, which means in Georgia, Republicans win next time.
That's what it is about, to exclude
10,000 or 11,900 votes, as happened in that state. Now, we all agree, New York is not an example. As a matter of fact, let me say, the United States is not an example. When you look at people around the world for the kinds of democracies that inspire them, it is not the United States. Electoral colleges, those kinds of conversations we have, are not inspirational to countries that want to introduce democracy. They're not thinking in the United States this bipolar situation with two parties is the model to follow. So we have lots of things to work on in this country.
We also have a lot of things to discuss, and we have a lot of letters. So let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll get to all of those. I'll go through the letters quick up to the top of the hour, and our panelists can comment on those, especially if their name is invoked. Save it for the show. We have all kinds of people.
Boy.
You know.
You wouldn't believe how interesting the conversations are once we are in break.
Just trying to rein everybody in. They want to get back and talk about this. So let's go to the letters here. It's not just one thing or another. I think we can commit to making voting better for everyone by both standardizing and improving voting registration and voting methods on a national level and improving and standardizing voting results management on a national level. Leaving it to the states means some voters will always be better off than others, and it should be as easy to register and vote in one place as another, and every vote should count. That from Mary Beth. Frank says, Alan is right. Get the filibuster.
I like this letter.
I know. Frank says, get the filibuster first before Mitch does. Greg says, I totally...
That's That's not what you said, though.
No.
No, but...
Okay.
But he said Alan is right,
no,
so...
This guy does. I know what he does. He always writes, Alan is right.
And then I'll read the letter.
Because he knows.
Then you get the letter read.
Yes,
that's
right.
That's a very clever strategy.
And then he tells you why you were wrong.
This person should be an advisor to the Democrats. Clear strategies
working. Yeah. Greg writes, I totally agree with Chris, and I am a liberal. There has been a knee-jerk reaction to the voting restrictions without looking at the details.
Oh, come on.
I don't know how knee-jerk. Well, okay.
Knee-jerk. It's about creating awareness, public awareness, that this is something under assault. This is a public relations campaign.
Why are all these states doing this? Come on.
So Linda asked the question. Linda asked the question, which I think exactly is what Alan is saying.
Alan is right.
I would like to ask Chris, says Linda, if Trump had won the election, would Texas be trying to change their voting laws?
That's a good question. I mean, I acknowledge that a lot of these lawmakers are responding to a Republican base that believes the election was stolen. I don't know. I mean, I think they might still be trying to ban things like drive-through voting and 24-hour voting. I don't know. It's a good question.
I'd say probably yes, because even if Trump did win, it would probably be close, right? And too close for comfort from their perspective.
Yeah.
And so they'd want to try to ensure that that doesn't happen again.
Well, and he won Texas, but probably that was too close for comfort.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. David says entirely the wrong things are being emphasized. What good are laws making it more convenient to vote if your vote can be thrown out by a partisan state legislature? Also, the Constitution is pretty explicit about the manner of selecting the electors being up to the states. Federal laws requiring 24-hour drive-through voting are likely to be challenged successfully by the courts. On the other hand, the Supreme Court has already told us they have no role to play in gerrymandering. Why not focus on what is not only more important, but can legally be accomplished? Greg says, hooray for Chris. Thanks for the unbiased view and for standing up to Alan.
Someone's got to do it.
Irene says, yes, Biden used the platform to make a very important point about what could potentially happen with voting suppression and in some places what really does happen. I do wish he chose different words here and there, but overall I think he maximized the time and platform to make very important points. A writes, the real revolt is not racial or class. It's the taxpayers versus those who vote to indenture their laborers and have it taken by force by government to give those who are not paying the taxes. Mark says there is a big difference between taking away voting rights and limiting voting access like Republican states are doing compared to the need for increased access in states like New York. In the case of Republican states, they are taking rights away for a clear purpose. In states like New York, we need to increase our access. To argue that states like Texas are already ahead of New York completely misses the point. D says, as long as we have the Electoral College, gerrymandering, and Citizens United, anything the Democrats do is just a Band-Aid on a severed artery. Where have I heard one person, one vote? Kathleen, Chris, does the Texas law, which you don't think is so bad, give power to the state legislature and to partisan poll watchers to change outcomes or reject votes they don't like? If so, how can you defend it?
I didn't, as far as the legislature, I have not seen that in any analysis of the tech. If it's there, then sure. And I'm not saying that I think the Texas law is great or even good or even necessary. What I'm saying is to call it the arrival of the Ku Klux Klan or to say that it's imposing Jim Crow is dishonest. That's not what it's doing. It is restricting voting, but it's still leaving a voting system in place that's more liberal than what many northern states have.
So let's get this straight. All of a sudden, maybe I'm losing my mind here sitting next to you, Chris, and I have a feeling that you're the one who's making that happen. But let's just say You see, all of these states, the Arizonas and all of the others, passing these restrictive laws at the same time.
Georgia, Pennsylvania,
why
Texas,
is that
Nevada.
Happening?
Let me ask you, why doesn't New York have more?
No.
But why doesn't New York?
No.
Why doesn't New York?
You can't answer a question with a question, Chris.
I'm asking a question, which is all of a sudden out of the skies, like the great.
I've already answered that question. Like what? In part, they're responding to their Republican. I fully acknowledge that the effort is in part based on is dishonest. But I think they're also among some. Some people, there are actually legitimate concerns.
Come on, somebody's calling in the plays here, and all of these Republican people are doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Why is New York's voting system more restrictive than Texas's?
It shouldn't be, and believe me, there are lots of problems with New York, and I acknowledge them, but that's not the point.
But why
the point
is
all of these Republican legislatures are following somebody's orders and getting in line and making it harder to vote, and you know it,
Demographic shifts in the South, and that's what they're concerned about. They have a long game plan to eliminate young Latinos, African Americans. It depends on the state you look at, but they want to not enfranchise. That is the problem in some of the southern states.
Malia?
Any Republicans listening to this are probably laughing right now because we're having an argument about things that we all agree on, but which is more important. Right. Whereas the Republicans now have a clear strategy and they're implementing the strategy. Right. And this is why I'm so concerned about what is the outcome of the meeting that Vice President Harris had and what is the Democratic National Committee going to be doing going forward? You know, what is the plan there?
Well, you can be sure that the reason, Malia, that Biden gave this speech is that people were shaking their fingers at him and saying,
"You're not doing
look,
enough, right?
They're going to, yeah, you're going to take away, they're trying to steal the democracy and you're doing nothing. You're just sitting there." So he got up there and he gave a speech. Could he have said more? Could he have said more, something about the filibuster? Could he have said more about the gerrymander? Could he have done all of that? Yes. But the fact is, he gave a speech which needed to be given.
Trump's America uses whatever language, right? And they lie in terms of using particular wording and describing issues or, you know, repeat it often enough, it makes it true. And we're having this debate over, you know, let's be most accurate. Let's be, you know, we are in this bipolar world where we just have to get...
But I think that Biden slipped into Trumpy language yesterday. I mean, that's part of my criticism.
How?
When you call this a new Jim Crow or say
I love that it's
it
Trumpy
is a new
language.
Jim Crow.
It's the new arrival of the Ku Klux Klan or the most significant threat to democracy since the Civil War. That's not true. None of those things are true.
It's absolutely true.
It's not true. You think that what's happening now is the most significant threat to democracy since the Civil War?
I do think
it's
that if
more
Trump
so
had
than,
its way,
than
I,
Jim
would
Crow
be a,
and the laws that restricted free speech or the cold, you know, the Red Scare.
If any of these work,
or Hitler, I mean, there have been a lot of threats to democracy over the years.
If any of these work and an election is overturned, that is a threat.
Right.
Yes?
Address the Electoral Count Act. That's what I'm going to keep hammering that until Biden. You know, finally hears me and does something.
address the real weaknesses
in our system. And January 6th and everything that happened before and after exposed a lot of those weaknesses. And we're not doing nearly enough to address those. We're focusing on drive-through voting and things that. I've open voting up entirely. I'm fine with that. But in this moment, focus on the things that happen after the election, because that's where the real threat is and was on January 6th.
The letter writer who said, if you can't get to the polls, what the H are you talking about?
Yeah, if you can't.
After the election. I mean, the fact of the matter is you're stopping people from getting together, going in a van, going to vote. And you're talking about, well, let's make sure that the votes are counted afterwards. Both are true, but you got to get there to vote.
All right, we'll take a break. I just, you know, call it my sixth sense, but I don't think we're done with this topic. So we'll come back, we'll continue, and we have many, many letters. We'll get to those, I promise. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. To be alone. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion, hour two, with our wonderful panel, Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Malia Dumont, and Vera Akarias-Kelly. We welcome your letters, panel, at wamc.org. We have a number of them, so I'm going to go as quickly as I can through them. And if anyone here wants to comment on them, please do, and then we will move on to other stuff. Carolyn, right, since all states are voting for one national election, shouldn't all states have the same voting rules? Why do they differ from state to state?
And that's why the Democrats are trying to pass some order out of all of this in the United States Congress, exactly for that reason.
Derek writes, it's not just laws making it harder to vote. It's new regulations allowing these swing states to overturn elections if they suspect fraud without any evidence. Said another way, they don't like the winner. They can cry foul and nullify the results. Kate, it's Northerners moving to Southern states that is changing the demographic. Andrea says the act of voting is not only a social responsibility, but also an avenue of freedom of speech. Let's discuss the concept of voting being freedom of speech. Anybody want to talk about that?
Yeah.
Hearing nobody. Did they? No, okay.
We agree.
All right, we agree. Okay. Andrea says the, no, I just read that. Robert, gerrymandering is the new Jim Crow. Gerrymandering in and of itself is vote suppression. But more importantly, gerrymandering is foundational to all vote suppression because ballot access policy is written by gerrymandered state legislatures. Voting is speech. Gerrymandering is a manipulation of legal free speech. It is a simple but abstract math trick that turned representative democracy upside down.
That last sentence is certainly true.
Mm-hmm.
That from Robert. Let's go to this letter, I believe, from Kate. Texas matters, and both parties know it. If Texas goes blue for the next general election, the crazy Electoral College will swing to the Democratic candidate. The Republicans will be forced to rethink a general election result as the actual detriment of how we elect our president. The Republicans of Texas are fighting hard to prevent what may well be inevitable.
Yep.
All right. Jim says voting should be simple and the process transparent. It should also be a well thought through and deliberate action and not an afterthought. I have just returned from France. Automatic registration, one day, Sunday, in-person voting only, ID required. Adding more options will complicate an already opaque system.
And can I say, as a European, I have yet to recall massive lines of people waiting to vote for hours. That seems rather disturbing in this country, too.
Yeah. Kathleen says, Chris, does the Texas law, which you don't think is so bad, give power to the state legislature and to partisan poll watchers to change outcomes or reject voters they don't like? If so, how can you defend it?
I'm not defending the Texas law. What I'm saying is that first of all, the poll watcher thing, you read different interpretations of that. I mean, what the law does is it allows the poll watchers to move more freely than their – I mean, some people call it a poll watcher protection, you know, legislation. I don't know. There's – the details of it change a lot, and it's hard to follow them. I'm not saying that the Texas law is good, though. What I'm saying is that the focus on what happens before and the break, my energy faded during the break.
I think what happened, you had coffee, and now you lost your energy. What happened?
I'm going to take a little nap. Come back strong for the second half of the my point is I'm not saying that the Texas law is great. I'm just saying that the hyperbolic descriptions of it, when it still leaves in a voting system that's more liberal than New York's, are not really honest or helpful.
We'll go to one more letter on this subject, and then we'll move on to other stuff. Tom says, how do Democrats celebrate the Texas representatives fleeing the state to avoid their legal obligations to attend voting sessions and look to abolish the filibuster to avoid obstruction by the minority party stating that the majority should rule the Senate? Seems to me the Democrats, as so many politicians, are hypocritical and have no principles. Thanks for having Chris on. He is the voice of reason.
Good Lord. There is no legal requirement to stay as the Texas legislature in Austin. you obviously saw your representatives from Texas working very hard, going to Washington, D.C., and discussing issues on their minds and meeting with the vice president and Schumer and possibly the president in consultations and developing strategy. This is what they do. They represent their voters.
But there is an irony there, which I think is what the letter writer is getting at, and that they are essentially filibustering. Right. They're filibustering. They're delaying the vote. And but at the same time, they're arguing for the removal of the filibuster federally.
So I'm just saying,
which
there's nothing illegal about what they're doing. They're also not abandoning their work.
You're gonna get
what
arrested.
They're doing.
I think actually it is illegal under Texas law. But that's a whole
that's why they
whole
sent
thing.
Law enforcement yeah. after them, or they yeah. thought they were. Yeah.
They yeah. They were talking yeah. about.
It, I mean, it's two different ways of disrupting the democratic process. Now, you can say the democratic process in Texas is broken, and that's why they're trying to escape it. But I agree with the letter writer. I mean, there is some similarity in between fleeing the state and putting
a
filibuster in place. This has the same yeah. effect.
It's a current delay because what the governor of Texas has said is he will go from special session to push something through. What option do you have to represent your voters that have a different position but to stop this special session?
You go, Vera.
Well,
I'm trying.
John writes, Vera is right, Chris is delusional. Thank you, Vera. Vera's absolutely correct.
I think Vera wrote that during the break. I saw her typing away.
What's
the IP address on them?
We can play Nicey Nice Nuance while the Republicans are running a propaganda machine. Chris, you're sitting there worrying that you've moved the rook too few millimeters from away from the edge of the square while the Republicans have, and this is all in capitalized shouty caps, thrown the board across the room, flipped over the table, stormed out of the building, and set it on fire. There you go.
Chris had too much coffee.
All right.
No, I'm going to keep repeating myself. The point of weakness is what happens. The Electoral Count Act could address a lot of what was horrifying on January 6th and the weeks leading up to it. Address that. No one's talking about that. Why we all saw the riot on January 6th. Why is nobody addressing what Congress was doing in that building on that day? That is a law that Congress put in place that makes that whole ceremony possible. Change it.
All right.
Wait.
Oh,
are you,
here we go.
Are you
I was this close from moving on. Go ahead.
Well, but they were there. They were doing their constitutional duty. They were counting the votes. And you're saying that was what was wrong with this?
There's a system in place where, and I'm, you know, the details of it, I'm probably going to mess up a little bit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if one member of the House objects and one member of the Senate objects, you can, there's a process in which they can deny the vote, essentially, or throw out the vote. Take that away. I think that since everybody agrees that the Electoral Count Act is an absolute mess and confusing and undemocratic in a lot of ways, change it. Everybody agrees that it needs to be changed, but no one's actually talking about changing it. It just seems so obvious to me.
I have no idea what you're talking about. I mean, they were there.
Do a little research, Alan. Prepare for the show ahead of time.
I do a little research. I get that, but they were there. They were supposed to count the votes. It was just, and they were besieged by a mob. And you're somehow saying it's the law, the counting law, that is the problem, as opposed to the fact that these louts, have invaded the Capitol, and I'm not hearing anything about that from you. It's not about the law. It's about the louts.
And it's about those that are now described as mere tourists who visited their capital, right?
My point was
those are the kinds of things that we now hear, and we need to set that right. We need to publicly discuss how there is a strategic effort by certain Republicans to numb us to what's happening, to redirect, to lie, to mislead, to obfuscate. And that is the plan. And I think what we saw from Biden was the initiation of the counter push that is now coming.
Malia, you picked a great day to come.
Yeah. I think we're all in agreement on a lot of things here, and we're quibbling about. This is why I said Republicans listening are probably laughing at us.
No, because we're almost anything.
I think we are quibbling about what to focus on, right? I'm saying focus on.
We all agree, expanded access would be a good thing. In the northern states, we agree that improving the Electoral Count Act would be a good thing. We agree that what happened on January 6th was a travesty. I don't understand what we're arguing about. Like, the focus needs to be on what happens next to make all of these improvements.
I'll tell you what I'm arguing about. I'm arguing about the fact that the Republicans clearly got together and decided in these various state legislatures where they lost, that they had to change the law so they could win, to make sure that they influence the way in which these votes are counted and everything else. It's disgraceful. And we're not on the same side about that. At least I don't think I'm on the same side with Chris here.
No, but I understand what Malia is saying, is that basically we're all saying that we want there to be a fair count and as many people to vote as possible.
But he wants to let them off the hook. Come on, Daddy.
Chris, stop wanting them to let... All right. Let's move on to other topics, if we may. We'll go to this topic. And that is infrastructure and negotiation. So while we're talking about what's happening and the possibilities of legislation moving its way through the House and Senate, we'll talk about this. Senate Democrats announced plans for a $3.5 trillion budget package to expand Medicare, advance Biden priorities. The agreement would mark effort to bridge differences between liberal and centrist wings of the party. Senate Democrats on Tuesday reached an early agreement to pursue a sweeping $3.5 trillion reconciliation package that would expand Medicare benefits, boost federal safety net programs, and combat climate change, aiming to sidestep Republican opposition and deliver on President Biden's top economic priorities. The wide array of planned health, education, and social programs would represent a historic burst of federal spending if lawmakers ultimately adopt it, as Democrats aim to seize on their slim but powerful majorities in Washington to expand the footprint of government and catalyze major changes in the economy. Alan Chartok.
What? I mean, he's doing it. This is his mandate as he sees it. He wants to make a difference while he's the president, and he's trying to do that. And those of us who believe that the middle class and the lower classes in this country have been screwed will wildly applaud this. And the people who have been holding on to power for years will not. He's doing it. Now let's see what Joe Manchin and the other people in that ilk want to do.
Vera?
Yeah, I mean, it'll be... I think it's a fundamental issue to get this package through. This is what was promised to the voters. The voters supported it. So now it's time to deliver, and they're in the process of doing it. These are very important, broad-based investments in the population of this country. So this has to go through, and with or without Republican support, this is what he was elected to deliver.
I think the infrastructure piece of it is particularly important. That'll bring a lot of new jobs, and our infrastructure is in such a terrible state in this country. The kind of investment is long overdue. The other piece that I'm really interested in is the climate change related pieces. There's some real chances for us to invest in new and innovative practices and technologies. And so that'll be really important, not only for jobs and the economy, but in terms of keeping the United States at the forefront of those kinds of innovations. So I think that's all very important. I'm sure, though, it's not helpful that this information came out yesterday that some of the indicators for inflation are
terrible.
Are terrible. So yeah. That's something that his administration will have to watch very closely.
What do you think, Chris?
So there are still two bills, right? There's still the primary infrastructure bill, and there's the secondary bill, right? So I still don't know. I mean, I don't think they have the votes to get the second vote. The second bill passed. I mean, Manchin is not going to go along with it. And I don't know if Kristen, is it her name? Kristen? Kristen Sinema?
Yeah. Kristen Sinema.
Yeah, if she'll go along with it. I don't know. We'll see. But I think there was this effort to tie the two bills together. I think that was fundamentally a mistake. I think you have to do the infrastructure bill first and then worry about the second one. But I don't know what their strategy. I mean, that's the strategy that Pelosi had been outlining. I don't know if she's going to stick to that, or if this somehow changes the calculus a little bit.
Well, but what do you really think in terms of what do you really think in terms of the wisdom of spending all this money?
It's a lot of money. I mean, there's good stuff in it for sure, but it's a lot of money. I do think the inflation concern is something that people will be paying attention to. You know, it's still it's down from what it was. They tried to scale it back to get more votes, but it's still still a heck of a lot of money.
And you know what? It's actually okay that Democrats, for a change, spend a lot of money, because Republicans have spent a ton of money and got us into a really big trouble in this country because it wasn't invested in communities, in the health of people, in infrastructure, in education. There has been
a border wall, not infrastructure.
Good example there.
Good point.
But, you know, those are the kinds of discussions we should have on all community levels. And, you know, you mentioned environmental impact. In this particular area, with all our rains, we have seen the poor shape the infrastructure is in terms of, you know, water runoff, canal systems, piping. I mean, what we are here in certain cities stuck in an era that was from 100 years ago. We have really big problems. And then on the West Coast, we have enormous wildfires that have to be fought, worse than ever in California.
Not just on the West Coast either, Hawaii.
Yeah, true.
Hawaii is having wildfires this year.
So overall, this country has not invested in its people, in its environment, in its youth, and in its healthcare system the way it needs to. And that is on the table. We can make certain choices. We have seen the horrors of what happened in Florida and Surfside when there are maybe not enough regulations, not enough oversight.
Or too much corruption.
You know, or too much corruption. You can go down the line of what is happening, but what is happening in Florida is certainly happening in other states on the West and East Coast along the water lines.
There's been some magical sinking.
Yeah. And, you know, you have a big storm and you just rebuild your house with insurance money in the exact same location. Why? It's time to rethink systematically where we're at here with our environmental structure, with our infrastructure. It is so myopic not to reflect on what we're facing, and that needs to be on the table.
I agree with everything you just said.
Oh, I'm glad.
But the problem is that there are large swaths of the population and those who vote and represent the people of this country who don't even acknowledge the existence of climate change.
Well,
so I mean,
or of getting a vaccination.
Right. I mean, there are these fundamental things that we have to overcome. And I'm not saying we shouldn't try. I'm not saying we can't. But, you know, if I don't know. I don't know how you then, because you're absolutely right. We need to change those things. But when we just talk about things like getting and I'm not anyway saying that this is a simple infrastructure bill that the president is putting forward. It is not simple. It is complex, but it certainly doesn't take care of all the problems, and it's highly watered down from what it was, and they can't get that through.
So on that particular issue, we know that, for example, COVID rates are exploding again in certain states in the South where people are under vaccinated. So what is needed is to rely on people in communities that are hesitant to actually speak out, those that have accepted the vaccine because they have experienced a death or a severe illness in their families. This has to be word of mouth now within communities. There is no government policy that will make a change. There is no physicians and nurses that are going to change people's minds. This is about trust. And who do you trust but people in your neighborhood? neighborhood by neighborhood, house by house.
I think Mr. Rogers sang about that.
You know, that's the way it works. And sorry to say, but this is how it works in developing countries. And apparently we are, in parts of this country, not accepting scientific evidence. So we have to use mechanisms that work in communities that are unwilling and untrusting to look at science.
Before you write letters, I think that was Bob from Sesame Street. I apologize. We'll be right back after this break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion, our last session with our terrific group this morning. Listening to Zan and the Winterfolk playing Cafe Lena. They're playing at the venue and streaming on the 15th, which I believe is tomorrow. Cafe Lena, two Fs, don't forget. CafeLena.org for more information. Great music that we've been hearing this morning. There's a playlist posted online at wamc.org/roundtable.
I know I shouldn't say this, but Roselle was a waitress at Cafe Lena, knew Lena quite well. And now she's one of the few remaining people who did. And when I questioned a lot of people who were at Cafe Lena, they didn't. Don't you see?
Didn't what?
You look. They didn't know her.
Oh, they didn't know Lena. Oh, they didn't know Lena. Oh, no.
Don't you see?
Oh, no, Lena was a great fixture and institution in the city of Saratoga. Yeah. Yes. And Cafe Lena goes on and doing very well. And
it's a beautiful place.
Kudos to them. So, again, you can find out more at cafelena.org. All right, let's go to another topic. In a milestone, Chuck Schumer is proposing federal decriminalization of marijuana. Senator Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, will offer draft legislation to remove marijuana from the list of controlled substances and begin regulating and taxing it. How far will this go?
It's a good question. It should go. I mean, it should be passed easily, but, you know, I don't know.
It has to happen. And the reason it has to happen is that the states have eliminated some of these regulations, and it's okay. But you run in, for example, WAMC is a federally chartered agency. So think about it. We can't
smoke pot in
smoke
here.
I wasn't sure where that was going either. No.
Our brakes are going to have to change a little bit.
Is that going to be on offer next time I come in?
I guess.
We can't take.
That's it. I'm out of here.
So you asked for hot chocolate during the break.
So, for example, we can't take underwriting.
Oh, I see.
You see.
Yes,
which
okay.
would endorse.
Because
the
pot shops that are legal in Massachusetts are not legal
which there are many.
Yet in New York and other parts of our listening area. Yep.
No, it's not only because of New York. It's because of the federal prohibition. Right. And we are a federally chartered agency. So, and we're just one. So it's a great idea.
Yeah, I mean, didn't even Clarence Thomas a few days ago say that?
I don't know. I don't take him as my guiding light.
But it shows. I think it shows how much the issue has moved when people like him are saying that the federal.
Right.
But people like him too have also been in favor of federalism, which is a bit, let the states do what they want. Mm. And this is the example of federal marijuana laws have kind of in some cases stamped on federalism.
So are you for it against it?
Of decriminalizing?
Yes.
Oh, 100% for it.
You mean at the federal level?
Yeah, yep. At every level. Oh, yeah. Federal, state, local.
Me too. And
radio
I've
station.
Never smoked pot in my life.
Central Avenue.
So every...
I tell you, I never smoked pot in my life. I wanted to be a congressman, so for most of my life, I decided not to smoke marijuana.
I think this actually enhances your chances
now
for being elected.
Well, it'll be...
But I'm old.
All you had to do was not inhale.
That's right.
Well, I think for the next roundtable, you should smoke it before you come on and tell everyone about your experience, and it'll be great radio.
Malia, anything on federal?
Or marijuana?
I agree. I mean, like Alan, I've never smoked pot. I don't intend to. I'm not personally interested, but it seems we've run into these situations with our students where we have lots of students from Massachusetts where it's perfectly legal, and then they show up in New York, they bring their apparatus with them, and we have to tell them, sorry, you can't do that here. And it's a difficult argument to make.
But federal decriminalization would still...
I like the term apparatus. Go ahead.
But that kind of thing could still happen, I think, right? Just because the federal government takes it off their list doesn't mean that a state couldn't say,
that's true.
So it won't solve all those issues. No. And, you know, I'm kind of in favor of letting states do what they want to do on things like this. I think it's a great idea.
So my students tell me that there are some versions of marijuana that are quite readily available that are laced, and those are quite dangerous. And so that is something states need to consider.
Well,
right?
That's an argument for some sort of regulation
sort
of state. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because most states, it is what it is purchased at the state.
Right.
At the state. Mm-hmm. Authorized facilities, right? Mm-hmm. Like a liquor license.
Correct. And regulating it, I think, makes a lot of sense to me. You know, decriminalizing and regulating.
But what it really comes down to, as Alan pointed out, is money. There's a lot of money at stake here, and there's no reason for it not to be available.
Yep. Especially for those that need it for medical reasons, mm-hmm. or need it for relaxation because they have... anxiety issues and so on, right? Mm-hmm. I think this is something that we should consider, in terms of revisiting. And I think when there's money in the game, mm-hmm. there's a higher chance we'll actually get it decriminalized.
Right. Well, all I got to tell you is, and Malia will know about this because of Simon's Rock, there are seven marijuana purveyor stores in Great Barrington, population 7,000. That's pretty good.
Apparently it's a good customer base then.
Yeah, there must be a need or you wouldn't have seven. That's pretty incredible. We have a few minutes I want to bring up. This is the top story on your newspaper, Chris, so let's talk about it. The federal count of New York COVID deaths is far higher than the state reports. So the question, did you not know that?
No, I did.
Oh, boy.
Here we go again.
I thought Chris was saying, again. Really? Yeah. That's the federal...
What newspapers are putting out? Wow. That's funny.
Man.
Check that out.
It's a good story. The federal government's count of the COVID-19 death toll in New York has 11,000 more victims than the tally publicized by the administration of Governor Cuomo, which has struck with a far more conservative approach to counting virus deaths. The discrepancy in death counts continued to widen this year, according to an Associated Press review, even as the Democrat has come under fire over allegations that his office purposely obscured the numbers of deaths of nursing home residents to protect his reputation, which, of course, is being looked at currently.
That's pretty big news. I mean, there have been a lot of allegations that, you know, Florida and other states were undercounting COVID deaths. And to find out that New York has been undercounting COVID deaths, I think is...
So what are the implications, Chris?
There's a lot of implications.
The governor who saw himself as a savior of...
Biggest implication is that you can't trust health information coming from New York State, which I think is, potentially disastrous.
But is there a political reason for that?
I think with the nursing homes, there clearly was a political motivation for that. He was under a lot of fire for the nursing home order, which sent COVID patients into nursing homes and then had a clear reason to want to underplay the number of deaths in nursing homes. I'm not entirely sure. Other than trying to make New York look like it did better than it really did, I don't really understand what any other motivation for this would be. And what they're doing is they're not counting people who die at home. They're not counting people who die in prisons. There's a long list of people. Basically, they're only counting people who die in hospitals, nursing homes, and other kind of quote-unquote official facilities.
Bob Anderson, who is chief of the Mortality Statistics Branch of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's National Center for Health Statistics, which is one of the cooler titles, I think, says, it's a little strange they're providing us with the death certificate information, so they have it. I don't know why they wouldn't use those numbers. The one thing about this, and I hesitate only because I don't want it to be perceived that I'm saying that 11,000 people isn't a lot of people, obviously, who died, and it seems like it's more of how it's being counted than something that they're trying to me, then the number would be higher if they were trying to obfuscate and am I right or not?
The number would be higher if they're, I mean, if they're trying to make New York look better, like if Andrew Cuomo's trying to make the state look like it performed better than it did.
You think you would do more than 11,000 is what I'm saying.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's
20%. Delta would be larger? Is that what you mean? Oh.
No. That's 20% of the total. I mean, that's a pretty big chunk
to
undercount.
No, it is a big number. No, it is.
Yeah. I mean, there's no excuse for undercounting COVID deaths just in general. I mean, honesty is what we expect from our government, especially about something like this. It's baffling.
Well, one could think of all kinds of reasons, right? I mean, you know, you got a governor who had positioned himself as the guy who was telling the truth and saving lives in COVID. And then all of a sudden, somebody puts a piece of paper in front of him and says, should we do 11,000 more, 11,000 less?
And how you count it, right? I mean, so the Cuomo administration's count includes, Chris just said this, but only laboratory-confirmed COVID-19 deaths at hospitals, nursing homes, and adult care facilities. That means its tally excludes people who died at home, hospice, in state prisons, or at state-run homes for people living with
disabilities. But they still died.
Right, exactly. It also excludes people who likely died of COVID but never got a positive test to confirm the diagnosis. And certainly tests were scarce in the early stages of the outbreak. At least 5,000 New York City residents likely died of COVID-19 without a positive test.
So statistically, what a lot of these offices do is they have an average year's death rate, and then they have a pandemic, and there is an overage of deaths, right? That's how they discover their discrepancies. That's how they begin to think about why is there a possible undercount, why is it in comparison to other locations, you know, who's included, who's excluded. These kinds of discussions we're actually very familiar with when it comes to the country of Brazil, right? There has been a systematic effort to undercount. India as well. We see political motivations on the top. Now here, this is a very interesting conversation. Why is the governor of New York potentially involved in suppressing, excluding, subcategorizing certain numbers of deaths?
If he is,
I think clearly somebody found a way, authorized, unauthorized, we don't quite know yet, we will find out, to exclude certain number of deaths because it looked better. We didn't want to panic for people who had their family members in nursing homes. These are the kinds of things that aren't supposed to happen when we are asking people to trust in science and trust our government. Right. We should get straight data. We should not get a fudging game like they do in Brazil.
That's absolutely right. Yeah.
And as the governor was addressing us every day on the status of the state's response, he was very critical of states that were not more forthcoming in the numbers that they saw. So now you look and see the, possible hypocrisy in that.
I'm going to hypothesize how this might have happened. So it's very possible that there wasn't an effort to exclude certain numbers, but certain processes or kinds of deaths, right? I doubt very much that someone looked at a piece of paper and said, 11,000 deaths, we're going to try to hide all that. But at the beginning, they set in place some procedures and there was an agreement, we're not going to include these kinds of things without really, projecting out how big that was going to be.
But we're a year and a half into this now.
Right. And there was no adjustment in the middle.
There's a CDC standard for counting. And
right.
One of the things that's a little weird about this is that with the nursing home things, we couldn't find out exactly how many nursing home residents died of COVID. Mm-hmm. The CDC you can find the CDC New York number. It hasn't been hidden. It's just that the state is reporting an entirely different number.
Yeah.
And Cuomo continues to put the lower number into his press releases and all the statements he makes. I don't understand exactly the point of that, but I don't think it's just like a clerical error you're excluding.
No, I don't think so either. Yeah. I think there's probably an expectation like certain categories were going to be much smaller, so let's not include those.
And the federal guy says they gave us the information. Mm. They're the ones who told us how many they had.
On the death certificates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have to wrap up. My thanks to everybody for being here. Alan, glad all is dry in your world. Thank you.
Everything is dry.
Yes.
Very nice. Very nice.
meaning,
anyway. Don't even bother.
Chris, thank you for being here. Nice to have you.
Yeah, it was great.
Malia, always really nice to meet you and to see you. And,
thank you.
We look
it's great
forward
to
having you back on the program. And Vera, thank you very much for
it's
filling
great
in today.
To be
I appreciate
here.
It. We'll
Thanks.
Be back right after this.